The first thing I'm going to do, this has come up implicitly in several talks before, but just to, since I'm going to be talking about this problem in a broader setting than some of the other talks, I figured I'd spend a couple of slides just reviewing the formalism of things like zeta functions. So X's sum will be some algebraic variety over a finite field. In cryptography, it's usually a curve, but for the purposes of describing this problem, I don't want to restrict to that. And besides, there are interesting cases where it's not a curve later. Q is always going to be a power of some prime P. So the zeta function of the variety X is this formal power series. You can also define it as an Euler product over closed points of X, or if you like, Galois orbits of FQ bar points of X. But in any case, you can think of it as this formal power series. You count points over various extension fields and you exponentiate this. So so variety of field is standard notation for the set of rational points at the variety over that field. So that's the basic object that one wants to, well, in this talk, one wants to compute this efficiently, sort of in terms of explicit, I mean, if you're given some explicit X written down in terms of some equations, you want to find this thing out. And of course, you could do it in principle by just sort of computing these numbers up to some bound where you knew that you had enough terms to denote this, and that's because of this fact. This series always represents a rational function of T. It's maybe not 100% obvious, it has integer coefficients, but from the Euler product expansion, it clearly has integer coefficients. And it also helps that you happen to know some restrictions on where the zeros and poles of things are. This is Deligne's proof of the last of the Vey conjectures. This will come up a little bit, but not too much. The more important thing for the moment is that it's a rational function. And so if you know what the degree of this rational function is, the degree of numerator and denominator, you could just sort of count these things physically until you have enough terms in the series that you can solve for the coefficients. But you typically don't want to do that. You want to do much better than that. So how this problem comes up in crypto is that, this again has come up in several talks, but I thought I would just throw it on a slide to be explicit. If X is a curve of genus G, the zeta function always has this particular form. You have in the denominator, you have 1 minus T and 1 minus QT. In the numerator, you have a polynomial of degree twice the genus, whose roots have the absolute value Q to the minus 1 half. It's sort of backwards from what you might be expecting, so that's why there's the minus there. So that is that's the Haase Vey bound in this situation, equality for the size of the roots is essentially the Haase Vey estimate. So I refer to computing zeta functions sometimes as generalized point counting, and of course that is part of the reason is because the very first coefficient of the zeta function, if you go back to that exponential, if you just look at it, the very first thing you get is the very first coefficient is the number of rational points over FQ. But that's not the sense in which it matters for cryptography. What matters sort of more in cryptography is sort of working with groups. That's what sort of algebraic geometry seems to do for crypto, is to provide groups. And the group here is the Jacobian. Well, this is an algebraic group. It's an abelian variety of dimension G. It's FQ rational points, which is what we typically work with. That's isomorphic to the group of divisor classes of degree zero, pick naught, over FQ. That group, its order can be computed if you know the zeta function. It's just this polynomial evaluated at 1. So if G equals 1, that's the case you may be most familiar with. This thing is just X, and this group structure really is just the group structure of the rational points of X. So of course, why that matters is because if you want to do some group-based cryptography thing, this group had better have hard discrete logs, and the discrete log is only as hard as the largest prime factor. So you want to know that this thing is nearly of prime order if you want to predict the security. Or even if it isn't, you want to be able to predict the security. So you presumably you compute this and see if it has a large prime factor. If so, you're happy. So that's why this problem comes up in this context, given x explicitly, typically you fix some class of varieties and choose x from there, determine this zeta function, and I should of course say determine it efficiently, but you do that. What sorts of classes do we talk about? Well, the first case where this sort of a lot of intensive work went into this is the class of elliptic curves over a finite field, FQ. But nowadays, since people like Tanya are interested in hyperelliptic crypto, not just Tanya, but many, several people, hyperelliptic curves of a fixed genus are also interesting. This question came up in Kristen's talk and Everett's talk. But you know, there are other classes that you might consider. For instance, you might consider smooth plane curves of a fixed degree. You might even leave the realm of curves. I'll do that at the very end of the talk. I'll say something about non-curves. But in any case, there are many classes where you could sort of make a well-posed question. What one typically asks for in a class where one wants to ask this question is that you can easily write down random things in the class. The algebraic geometer's way of saying that is you have a unirational moduli space. So you can write down a big parameter space where outside of some closed subvariety, most of the things in the parameter space correspond to varieties in this class. So you can easily write down elliptic curves, hyperelliptic curves, smooth plane curves. There are some exceptional cases that you skip over. It's also helpful if you know something about the shape of the zeta function. If you know, for instance, if being in this class restricts the degree of the numerator and the denominator to be some particular thing, or if it provides you some fixed factors. So, of course, in the case of a curve, which in the previous slide, I'll write that again. So, already being a curve restricts the shape of the zeta function, particularly if you know the genus, because you have the two fixed factors down here and you have this thing of fixed degree up here. But if, for example, X has additional automorphisms, that might restrict this even further. You might know that this has some repeated factors. Any information like that typically helps you, at least in principle, not so clearly in practice. Okay, so that's the problem, and so what sorts of approaches we have? Several of these have come up. As I said, you could count points physically, but that's usually a bad idea. For curves, you can, at least if you're interested in the Jacobian order, this is really only a method for finding the Jacobian order, but you can do what's called the baby step, giant step method, which came up in Renata's talk. You can sort of use the fact that you know something about the order of this Jacobian from the Hasse-Wey bounds. It's in that interval, and so there's a generic algorithm for finding a group whose order is in some, finding the order of a group given that the order is in some range. And then there are several other techniques that kick in when you're working in small characteristics. So in this talk, I'm mostly going to talk about small characteristic. So, of course, Q is power of 2 is the prototypical example of small characteristic, but we won't be forced to be restricted to characteristic 2, since in some cases, in other applications, maybe one's interested in other characteristics. In small characteristic, there are a number of interesting techniques that appear. For example, for elliptic curves, two techniques that were introduced was with the method of Sato, where you compute the Serre-Tate canonical lift. You start with, say, an ordinary elliptic curve in characteristic P, and there's a special way to lift it to an elliptic curve with complex multiplication in characteristic 0. And you compute that lift, and then you can read off the zeta function having done that. So that's a good technique for elliptic curves in small characteristic. An even better technique in small characteristic, at least for elliptic curves, is Mestre's arithmetic geometric mean. That's what AGM stands for. It's the sort of adaptation of Gauss's AGM iteration for computing. It computes, it's great for computing zeta functions of ordinary elliptic curves. You can also use it in some other cases of low genus, genus 2, probably genus 3. I think both the hyperelliptic and non-hyperelliptic of genus 3, because I think Ritzenthaler worked this out. But it has bad dependence on the genus. So, and Sato's method really isn't so good in higher genus because it depends on taking the Jacobian the curve and lifting it as an abelian variety, you won't get a Jacobian anymore. So there are some issues. So these techniques are both good. They're both really for low genus curves, most effectively. The most flexible technique, which works in many cases, besides curves of extremely low genus, is this use of p-adic cohomology, which is what the rest of this talk is about. I should, of course, mention this close method because it came up in Kristen's talk and Jean-Marc's talk, that you compute the zeta function mod L for many small primes L. This is a pretty good method for elliptic curves in small characteristic. It's pretty much the only method for elliptic curves in large characteristics. So if you work over GFP, where P is of cryptographic size, you have to do this. You have no other option. And it works decently well. It's fine for in the cryptographic range. If you start trying to do this in higher genus, the dependence is quite bad. I think it's maybe e to the g squared or something. It's that kind of bad. The best known version of this, which is the generalization by Pila of Scope's method. And already for p equals 2, for g equals 2, as Kristen sort of ran across in her talk, it's quite difficult to do this. And of course, I should put in a plug for what happened in, this isn't the plug. So before I do that, I'll just remind you from the previous talk, the discussion in the previous talk was about sort of doing the same sort of thing in other situations for modular forms. So this is a good method, but for the particular problem of computing a zeta function of a curve of genus bigger than one, it's not so well developed. This is really a problem, is to sort of improve this. And in fact, one concise way to formulate this problem is to ask, is finding the zeta function of a curve of genus G over FQ polynomial time simultaneously in the genus and log of the field size? And this is only known to be true in a quantum computation model, because there you have the trick that you can read off the order of the Jacobian over FQ, over FQ squared, and so on, and so you can recover the zeta function from enough Jacobian orders. But in any classical model of computation, I only know how to do this individually. Fixing G and varying this using the Scoff-Pila method, or fixing at least the characteristic of the field and varying G, that's with p-adic cohomology. So this is an interesting sort of complexity theory question that we're kind of stuck on. Okay, so for the rest of the talk, what I'm going to do is set up this framework in which one uses this mysterious gadget of p-adic cohomology to compute zeta functions. Then I'll sort of go back to 2001 when people like me first started thinking about this. And the example of hyperelliptic curves is the case that is the best understood, certainly by me, and is also the best implemented. So I'll go back to what we know about hyperelliptic curves. There are still questions, especially of an implementational nature in that case. Then I'll talk about various generalizations, which I promised in my abstract, sort of increasing the class of curves, improving the memory usage, because this is actually going to be quite memory-intensive operation, and maybe getting away from the class of curves. So that's the plan. We'll see how we do. So what's the framework? The framework is that you have this zeta function, and the way you interpret it, this is essentially the idea of Ve, is you interpret the zeta function by constructing a cohomology theory for algebraic varieties. What that means for the purposes of this talk is, given a variety, you have some black box, some functor, that when you stick in a variety, it spits out a bunch of vector spaces with indices over some field that you happen to know what it is. Usually you want this to be characteristic zero. And you want these things to be equipped with, each of them should be equipped with a linear transformation F, and you want this to happen. This is essentially the analog of the Lefschetz fixed point formula in topology. Right? In topology, when you have a map from a topological space to itself, you count fixed points with some multiplicity by looking at the action of this map on cohomology, you take some alternating sum of traces. So in algebraic geometry, life is a little bit simpler. There are no multiplicities. You simply count. This is supposed to be the fixed points of the nth power of Frobenius, because you know if you apply the q to the n power map on fq bar, these are the fixed numbers. So these are supposed to be the fixed points of the nth power of Frobenius, and so this is supposed to be computed by this alternating sum minus 1 to the I trace of f to the n on this vector space. You want characteristic 0, because if the characteristic is p, then this isn't so much information. This is only a congruence mod p. So you really want this in characteristic 0. And it's a formal consequence that if these are finite dimensional, which you, in any self-respecting situation, that's what will happen, this zeta function can be expressed as an alternating product. This minus 1 to the I plus 1 means that the 0, so here, in this situation, this stuff would be coming from h0, this would be coming from h2, and this would be coming from h1, so that's what that minus 1 to the I plus 1 is doing, is flipping things on the downstairs. You get these characteristic polynomials. That's what this is. The characteristic polynomial of f on this vector space. And this alternating product gives you the zeta function. So instead of trying to compute this in the cohomological framework, what you do is you set up some cohomology theory and then try to compute this in some meaningful sense, and then compute the action of f in some other meaningful sense. I'll give you a meaningful sense in a moment. First, I should point out the original example of this, which was introduced by Grothendieck, is Étale cohomology, which takes coefficients in the field of L-adic numbers, where L is some prime which is not P. This is implicitly used in Skolf's algorithm. Actually, you really use the mod L version of this, but the formalism is similar. So this is implicitly used in what we heard about in Kuvenya's talk about Edekshofen's method for computing coefficients of modular forms. But this is really only computationally effective in certain limited circumstances. For example, curves of genus 1, you can do that. Curves of genus 2, it's tricky, and I have no idea how to do this, for example, for surfaces. I don't know how to compute the middle Étale cohomology of a surface. That's not quite true. I know what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to take if I have some surface with FL coefficients, I'm supposed to realize this as being the same thing as the Étale, as you know, because this is Mod-L, the Étale cohomology of some curve with FL coefficients, and then sort of deal with this. But this is actually, this curve will be very complicated. This is in the same spirit as what happened in the previous talk, where you started with the weight 12 modular 4, which naturally sits inside H11 Étale, some variety, and you use some congruence to get to a curve, to get to a weight 2 situation, but the modular form varies and its level is changing. So that's a very analogous situation, but I have no idea how to make that practical. Although I think Jonathan Pila has some ideas about this. So I'm not going to go anywhere near that. I'm going to use this p-adic technique, which is called the cohomology theory of Monsky-Washnetzer, or MW. In this case, what you get are vector spaces over a field, a p-adic field. Well, it isn't literally the field of p-adic numbers unless you're working your varieties over fp. It's what's sometimes called qq, the finite unramified extension of this thing with residue field fq. So it's just, if you want, you can just pretend that q equals p, and I'm talking about the p-adic numbers. Of course, that's not so good for applications where you're interested in, say, f2 to the n. But if you've never dealt with the p-adic numbers before, and there may be a few people in here who haven't much, I should point out these things are, of course, you imagine p-adic numbers as base p expansions which go infinitely far in the wrong direction. They go infinitely far to the left instead of to the right. And the effect of that, or any other definition which may be more mathematically formal, is that you can only approximately specify these things in computation. You can't, just as you can't actually write down a random real number unless it's special, and unless it's rational, or if you happen to know secretly it's an algebraic number, you can sort of pop out digits that way. But if you just want to specify some random real number, you can only do that approximately. And likewise with p-adic numbers, you can only specify them approximately. So whenever you're computing with these things, you're only really computing approximate things. So in particular, you only, you know, if you sort of know a basis for this thing in some effective sense, you can only compute the action of f as some matrix which is determined approximately. So sort of modulo some power of p. This gives you issues of p-adic precision. It's very much like doing numerical methods over R. You have to worry about precision and loss of precision. I'm just going to ignore this here for expositional simplicity. The theory of sort of monitoring the p-adic precision is actually somewhat different than over R. You use much more algebraic geometry to do this. But there is there's a huge lump under the rug here that I'm completely ignoring. But if you actually read my papers, then this sort of gets dealt with in somewhat painful detail. So going back to up here, the fact that you can only sort of do things approximately, well, that seems like, well, how can I actually write down the Frobenius matrix and extract the characteristic polynomial and find the zeta function? Well, of course, you remember the coefficients of the zeta function are integers, and you can say something about how big they are. So if you write down some absolute bound on the size of whatever numbers you're trying to compute, say the coefficients of this thing, for curves you can use the Hasebe estimate to get a very good bound. It may be more complicated, and you can always write down some bound, some sort of Archimedean bound, if you like, on the size of the coefficients, and then you compute those same coefficients by doing a p-adic calculation to some accuracy. And if you do enough accuracy, and you have to keep track of how much accuracy you're getting, then you nail things down exactly. Because, you know, if you know a number both in, you know, approximately in the Archimedean sense and approximately in the p-adic sense, oh, and if it's an integer, then, you know, it's in some range, it's in some arithmetic progression. If you, you know, if you make those things compatible in the right way, then you uniquely determine the number. So that's the basic paradigm, is that you compute things approximately. And you keep track, which I'm not going to talk about in this talk, you keep track of how much accuracy you need to nail down the zeta function. So for the most of the rest of the talk, I'm just going to concentrate on how do you get a hold of the action of Frobenius on a basis of cohomology, approximately. And even that, in a little bit, in somewhat sketchy form. One thing I need to point out is that this theory only works for affine varieties. So something like a projective, like, you know, your typical curve is projective. I mean, when you typically get curves, you often get them as projective curves, which have no missing points, and you can't do this calculation directly on those. So typically, you take some stuff out. So for example, as Gerhard mentioned in his talk, when you start with a curve, you have to take out at least one point in order for it to become affine. In higher dimensions, you have to take out maybe more stuff. But in any case, if you start with some x, you can typically take out some variety of lower dimension to leave behind something affine. And this zeta function is completely multiplicative in terms of disjoint unions of varieties. If x is the disjoint union of u and y, then its zeta function is the product of these two zeta functions. And that just comes from the original definition. Because the number of points is an additive function. So when you exponentiate, you get this multiplicative thing. So normally when you do this theory is, as a backstop, the worst case scenario is you have to sort of calculate this, the zeta function of this affine part using this cohomological technique, and then the stuff that you threw out is lower dimensional, so you sort of deal with that, and, you know, if you started with a curve, what's left over maybe is some points. They might not be rational over your base field, but in any case, it's an easy problem to, that's just polynomial factorization. I mean, it's distinct degree factorization to find the zeta function of a zero-dimensional variety, so that's easy. Sometimes you can get away without this, and you'll see that occasionally in my examples. Right, so this is just an example of what I said before. If you start with a hyperelliptic curve in P2, you might take out the point at infinity or points, depending on whether it's in the real or imaginary form, in the sense of Renato's talk. You might take out more points, as you'll see very shortly. So how you normally use this theory, this is extremely rough. I've already swept stuff under the rug. I'm sweeping tons of stuff under the rug here. But this is meant to convey the spirit more than the technicalities So the basic idea is, and you'll see this fleshed out a little bit more on upcoming slides, you start with your smooth affine. So now I'm just assuming X is smooth affine. So it might be, you know, the affine part of a hyperelliptic curve. It starts out being defined over a finite field FQ. You lift it to what I call ZQ, which I didn't define, but it's the ring of integers in QQ. So you start with a field of p-adic numbers, and then you have to make this extension. So the p-adic numbers contain, So the ring of integers and the p-adic numbers are the p-adic integers. These are right things that go infinitely farther to the left but have no decimal digits after the radix point. So when you make this unringified extension, you correspondingly get a ring up here called ZQ, which is the integral closure of ZP in here. This thing has residue field FP. If you take this ring to mod out by P, you get this. If you take this ring and mod out by P, you get the finite field FQ. So you lift your smooth variety from here to here, meaning you start out with some equations defining this thing over FQ, and you just sort of, every time you see a number in FQ, you just pick a lift of it to ZQ, and that defines some lift. Of course, in practice, you really better be doing something more sensible than that, otherwise you can't use the result. So this is sort of fine print for algebraic geometers in the audience. The lift is supposed to be a complement of a relative normal crossings divisor inside a smooth proper scheme over ZQ. That will be true in all of my examples, so just ignore that. The next thing you have to do is you have to sort of, this thing, because it lives in characteristic P, it has a Frobenius automorphism, endomorphism. And you have to lift that. So I'm going to lift, you lift the P power one, and then the one that you really want is the Q power one, but it's cheaper computationally to lift the P power one and then iterate that. The fine print here, in this case, is that this lift is not going to be a map from X to itself as an algebraic variety, meaning it's not going to be written down as polynomials, because very often you could prove there is no polynomial lift of the Frobenius map. You just can't write it down. I mean, it just doesn't exist. So this is going to be some sort of p-adic power series map, and it's going to have some technical condition that it's over-convergent, which I won't explain what that means yet. I'll maybe flush it out a bit in an example. But the point is that you're doing something which, this step is really still algebraic geometry. You started out with some polynomial equations downstairs, and you lift them to polynomial equations upstairs. But this is really a p-adic analytic operation. You're writing down infinite series with some sort of p-adic convergence property. This is not algebraic geometry anymore. And then you do this, and now you want to, now there's some sort of, remember I said there was supposed to be some sort of vector space. The vector spaces are what are called algebraic Durand cohomology. So if you imagine what Durand cohomology is, it's differential forms. You know, you sort of write down, you know, in differential topology, what is Durand cohomology? You have some manifold, you have differential forms on there. There's a derivation map that takes n forms to n plus one forms. You take, sort of Durand cohomology would be closed forms, meaning forms where d equals zero, so the kernel of d modulo exact forms, which are things. So this is sort of a kernel of the exterior derivative map, and this is the image of the exterior derivative map coming from one lower. So Durand cohomology and topology is formed as some sort of kernel mod image, and that's what's going to happen here. It's going to be defined algebraically. And again, I'll write down an explicit example of this. And then you take this ring map that you have here, and you sort of formally apply it to the differential forms that give some basis. And then you get into a tricky situation, because this is a sort of a typical thing that mathematicians do that makes computational people cringe, is we define some finite dimensional vector space as the quotient of two infinite dimensional vector spaces. This is bad for computation. In the examples that we're interested in, it happens to be the case that not only can you write down elements in here that give you a basis, but given a random element in here, you can actually effectively write it as a linear combination of basis elements. that's, you know, that's not clear from just making the definition, but it turns out to be the case in examples, and that's sort of what makes this theory really useful, is that it has that property. So that you can really do this, write down the action of Frobenius, well, approximately, on Durand cohomology. Because, of course, this is some infinite series, so you're only gonna truncate it. Okay. So, problem along the way, since it's fashionable to talk about pairings in cryptography, I should mention, there is a pairing that's relevant in this situation. There's cup product in Durand cohomology. Whether it is of any use in computing zeta functions, I have no idea. It's entirely, my suspicion is that it really only matters in terms of constants, because it might, if you have a curve of genus G, and there's a, so the matrix of Frobenius here is going to be a 2G by 2G matrix. It may be that using the pairing, you can cut out maybe one quarter of that matrix, or maybe two quarters. So, as I said, I'm just doing it to be trendy. okay, so now to an example. So this is the original case of computing pedantic cohomology that I introduced in 2001, and sort of unbeknownst to me at the time, was about to start a sort of a small industry. So take your hyperelliptic curve, and I'm making this very special. That's these weasel words are meant to point out that I'm being very special here. So I'm going to work an odd characteristic on this slide. I'll come back to even characteristics later. And I'm in what Renata called the imaginary case, where there's only one point at infinity, which is a Weierstrass point. Again, I'll say something about the real case later. So what that means is that I write down a monic polynomial of degree 2g plus 1 over my field fq. But so I'm going to take the hyperelliptic curve, and I'm going to take out the point y equals infinity, which is I should say x equals infinity. Yeah. Okay, I'm minus the points y equals 0 is really what I do. I want to take out the Weierstrass points. But I'm going to take out all of the Weierstrass points, not just the one at infinity. So this gives me an affine variety, but the ring of functions on it is not just fq adjoint xy mod y squared minus p of x. I also have to throw in the inverse of y, which is to say I throw in z and then yz equals 1. So this thing has the effect of taking out those extra points where y equals 0. Now the reason I'm doing this is purely for expediency. The theory works perfectly well if you don't take those points out, because you already get an affine variety with one point missing. But it's really convenient to do this, because then it's really nice to compute Frobenius. So how am I going to lift Frobenius? Well, I'm going to lift p to some p tilde. I just pick some polynomial. In fact, you typically pick it in an algebraic extension of q. You just pick algebraic integer coefficients so that you can write them down exactly. But you want it to stay monic, so it will have the same degree. And now you lift Frobenius like so. So x, you just lift to x to the p. I should say something about coefficients. There is a standard, well, in fact, there is a unique map on QQ, which sort of acts on ZQ, and it acts, and it sort of reduces to here the p power map. It reduces to the p power map here. There's a unique such map. So I'm not going to say anything more about it. It's constructed using, if you like, the theory of fit vectors. But anyway, there is a unique map on here which sort of carries this thing into itself and acts as a p power map right here. I'm calling that sigma. So you better be doing that to coefficients, and I'm going to do this to x. And now I should tell you what happens to y. What happens to z is just going to be the inverse of this. So what happens to y is it goes to y to the p times this thing. Now, this is where you leave the realm of algebraic geometry. So I wrote the two p's here, which of course cancel out, but the point is that this thing, without the p in front, has integer coefficients, because these two things are congruent mod p. This is, you apply sigma to coefficients and then sub in x to the p, and this is, you just raise the thing to the p power. These two are congruent mod p, so I get to divide out by a p. I'm also going to divide out by y to the 2p, because this is effectively multiplying by z to the 2p. And now this thing is 1 plus a multiple of p, so I can take this thing to the 1 half power, and it makes sense in, for example, the p-adic completion of zq adjoint xyz mod y squared minus p tilde of x, and so on. In any case, the point is it's non-algebraic. It's some sort of p-adic series. And in fact, it's actually a so-called overconvergent series. What that over means is, roughly speaking, the degrees of the terms you see in here grow linearly with the power of p sitting in front. So in term, you have, you're going to get p times some stuff to the degree p times 2g plus 1, and then in front of the p squared, you might get something like 2p times 2g plus 1 for the degree. So you don't get, you know, exponentially large degree for sort of a polynomial number of factors of p. So that's what over means, and that matters simply because it makes the action on this cohomology well defined. And here's what the cohomology is. Omega 1 is the module over the series ring, which I didn't tell you what it was explicitly, but it's some ring of p-adically over convergent series. It's generated by dx and dy modulo this relation, which is, of course, the derivative, formal derivative of y squared equals p tilde of x. So my cohomology in this case, there's only an h1 that matters. There's an h0, but it's sort of trivial. You take this thing, so this is going to be all of my forms, and in this case, everything is going to be closed because I'm at an affine one-dimensional thing. So it turns out everything is closed, but the exact things are really just df for f in the ring. And if you work out what this is, it turns out to be finite-dimensional, and it has a basis given by some things of the form blah times dx over y, and some things of the form blah times dx over y squared. These are the things you're really interested in. These turn out to be an artifact of the fact that I threw out extra points. Another way to say that is, this hyperelliptic curve has an involution, y goes to minus y, and these things are odd. They get negated by the hyperelliptic involution, and these things get fixed by the hyperelliptic involution. So you can actually separate them, which is what you do in practice. But in any case, whether you have something odd or even, there's a nice algorithm to take an element of this thing and rewrite it as a linear combination of these things plus an exact thing. Basically, what happens is you look at the highest power of y. I won't write these formulas out, but you have some large power of y. You have some stuff up here. You can write it in terms of dx because you can solve for dy. You write this thing as a multiple of p plus some other multiple of p tilde. Notice that because I actually was getting a hyperelliptic curve of genus g, that was a fancy way of saying that this polynomial had no repeated roots, or even its reduction mod p had no repeated roots. So that means that this thing and this thing are relatively prime. So every, you know, you can write one as a linear combination of these things. So you can write any polynomial as a linear combination of these things. So you take whatever your numerator is, you write it in terms of these things, and now you split into two terms. This cancels a y squared downstairs. And this thing, there's a special relation that turns blah times p prime over this thing into, you get some derivative of blah, you get your p tilde, and then you get y to the star minus 2. And then there is some constant that I forget what it is. So in any case, in both terms, you get to lose two factors of y down here. And so that's how you win. So if you have some big element of omega 1, it's got some horrible, horrible factor of y downstairs, you do this kind of roll-down operation repeatedly, and you can put things in terms of the basis elements. So that's what you do. You truncate the Frobenius on the ring, you apply it to basis elements, you do this roll-down, and you get a sort of approximate matrix that tells you how Frobenius acts on cohomology. And then you get to read off the characteristic polynomial, and then an approximate version of the zeta function. So that's how this goes in this setting, and this actually really, really works. So you can compute this zeta x. In this particular case, I said the estimates are soft O's, so log factors ignored of genus cubed. Let's see. Oh, this is backwards. Sorry, it's genus to the fourth n cubed, and the space is genus cubed n cubed. So that's also backwards. So it's g to the 4 n cubed. And this is supposed to be, this should be true, n is the factor of the exponent of p and q. As I said, this is what I had in my original paper. So this is for p naught 2 and x imaginary. Can you remove the restrictions of the previous statement? So for p equals 2, Dan Bernstein and I talked about this at Oberwolfach last summer, and I never actually worked out the details, but I'm pretty sure we can, this. you can get these, you can, these are sort of the optimal asymptotics that you can get even for p equals 2. Is that fair characterization?
Well, I think there was another potential bottleneck, which I didn't see the issue why it was slowing down the output. There were two potential bottlenecks.
Oh, did we only fix one of them?
Parameter. I don't remember all the details in the algorithm.
Right, I mean, what happens with them is I think they get this in the, I think they get the right estimate in the best case.
Yeah.
But
there were two potential bottlenecks, and one of them is through.
One is not always in the best case. So, for example, I think Tanya was asking me this morning about the case of a curve of, so the best case, I guess, is ordinary. And sometimes, so Tanya was asking me this morning about genus 2, not ordinary, but not super singular either, sort of a middle case, like P rank, was it P rank 1? Is that the good or middle case? That's the middle case that she was interested in. And you don't get the optimal, it's worse than you don't just get the optimal thing here. You don't actually get to use the implementation in Magma. So Magma has implemented by Michael Harrison the complete algorithm for P not equals to 2. He actually did the real case. It's unpublished, so, but I guess if you own a copy of Magma, you can actually look at the Magma code, because it's not bundled in the kernel. I think it's actually provided as code, so you can actually look at the code, which I'll come back to in a moment, but he didn't write up a paper explaining what was going on, so it's hard to say exactly what the status of the real case is. The P equals 2 case, as I said, probably everything is okay. The only issue is that, so Deneff and Verkaderen worked out the P equals 2 case, but there are some issues with the exact runtime estimates, whether they're as good as in the odd case. So as I said, this is mostly implemented in Magma, so you can actually, so I tried this about half an hour ago, I fired up Magma, and P doesn't have to be that small. I think I took a prod of about 500, and I think I took N equals 10, and did a genus 2 curve, and that was no problem. P doesn't have to be tiny for this. P can be not so small. And this works reasonably well. The best you're going to do, as far as I know, is get a linear dependence in P. So, although I think Gaudry has some idea about doing a square root of P. But in any case, you're hosed in large characteristic, as I said. I'm not talking about large characteristic in this talk. I should make one advertisement for another application of this that has nothing to do with crypto. In genus 1, this calculation has a completely different relevance. If you think about the regular Birch-Swinnerton-Dyer conjecture for elliptic curves over Q, so it tells you the rank of an elliptic curve has to do with the order of vanishing at the critical point s equals 1 of the L function, and then the leading coefficient after you strip off the vanishing tells you information about things like the order of the Tate-Chaffer average group and the regulator of the group of rational points. There is a p-adic version of this due to, I guess, Maser, Tate, and Teitelbaum of the Birch-Swinnerton-Dyer conjecture, which we also know something about, I guess, by work of Kato. And it has a corresponding, so there's some p-adic L function, and you look at the order of vanishing at some special point, and that tells you something about rank, and then the stripped-off coefficient tells you something about a p-adic regulator. Well, that's computed using some sort of p-adic global canonical height, not to be confused with the neuron local height, which did explicitly come up in Joe Silverman's talk yesterday, but this is some sort of global p-adic height associated to elliptic curves over Q, so it's some function that takes elliptic curves and rational points on them over Q, not curves over QP, but curves over Q, and it spits out certain p-adic numbers, and it's a quadratic form, and so on. And this shows up in this Birch-Swinnerton-Dyer conjecture, and so there's a question about how to compute this. And Maser, Barry Maser, William Stein, and John Tate have a paper to appear in the Coates birthday volume, where they do this using an idea of cats combined with exactly this algorithm in the case of genus 1 over FP. So it's a case that's completely uninteresting for crypto. Genus 1, small field, not just small characters, but actually small field. But it has this interesting arithmetic significance. And David Harvey has actually implemented this special case in William Stein's open source system, Sage, and is really quite good. He hasn't tried to do the more elaborate version where you allow non-prime fields on higher genus, but perhaps he can be persuaded.
You cannot rule out crypto connections.
You can never rule out crypto connections. This is true. Yeah, it would be dangerous to do so. Okay, so I promised more curves. So now let me tell you a little bit about a new class of curves, which more recent work of... So Jan Deneff has really become a champion of this p-adic cohomology business. So Frevre Kateren was his PhD student at the time when my paper appeared. Kateren did his thesis on... His thesis was essentially the characteristic two version of the thing I showed on the previous couple slides. Kastrick is another, as a current student, I believe, of Deneff, or maybe just finishing. And they've worked out a big generalization of what I just described. And it takes the setting of what are called non-degenerate curves. So what is a non-degenerate curve? So if you write down some random polynomial actually it could be a Laurent polynomial, inverse powers of x and y are okay, although it doesn't really matter for what I'm about to say. So you write down a Laurent polynomial, and you look at which coefficients are non-zero, and you plot those as points in R2, and you get what's called the Newton polygon. It's usually called the Newton polytope, and probably I should have called it that even though it's two-dimensional, because I don't want to confuse it with the use of Newton polygons to factor polynomials over a p-adic field, even though it's related. So the curve is non-degenerate if there's some conditions, there's some generic restrictions. So first of all, this thing should not have any singularities in GM squared. So the affine plane minus the axes. So it should be non-singular there. It's okay if it has singularities where x equals y, or x or y equals zero, because I'm going to put in this extra condition that's going to sort of fix things up. So for each segment of this Newton polygon, you strip out the terms along that segment, and you try to factor this thing, and you make sure that it doesn't have any repeated factors other than monomials, which somehow don't matter. Let me show you what I mean by this. So here's a polynomial, and I was thinking of doing this in Xfig in here, but A, that was going to take too long, and B, I couldn't fit everything and the picture on the same slide. So I'm just going to draw this. So where do I get points in this picture? I get one at 4, 0, 3, 0, 2, 0, 1, 0, 2, 1, 1, 1, and 0, 2. So in this case, this is my Newton polygon. So I take a convex hull of those points and I get that. And so now the condition I have to check for non-degeneracy is first I have to make sure that this thing has no singularities in the plane away from x equals y equals 0. And so I put that into singular, and that gives me this cubic restriction that this cubic polynomial should fail to vanish. So, of course, it's a generic restriction. This is always going to be some sort of generic restriction on coefficients. And I guess I'd better take p not equals to 3 so that this is valid. I want these things to have no repeated monomial factors. Oh, this better say plus or minus 2, shouldn't it? In any case, you do this two-dimensional thing, and then you check this one-dimensional thing, whether any of these have repeated factors. And notice that the coefficient of xy isn't making any difference at all at this stage. It only matters in the first step. And these secretly come from the theory of toric varieties. You're supposed to draw this on a certain toric surface. So if you know about toric varieties, then keep that in mind. Otherwise, forget that. The important thing is that the genus of this curve can be easily seen in this picture. It's the number of interior lattice points. So here, that's 1, because this point that I'm focusing the dot on is the only interior lattice point. Boundary lattice points, like the one on that long side, I don't count. One reason it's helpful to know about toric varieties is because people who've studied toric varieties have been dealing with this stuff for years, and they are extremely good at dealing with the Durand cohomology of these things. So you get to plug in lots of existing theory when you try to compute the cohomology of these things. And the main new thing you have to do is you have to compute a Frobenius lift. And Kastrick and F. Kateren actually tell me how to do this. But there's a fly in the ointment, which is that x and y both have to be lifted to series. you don't get to lift x to x to the p, and then y is something complicated. So you have twice as much complication running around, and that. So this is okay. This has okay, this is maybe too strong. It has okay asymptotic behavior. It has kind of terrible constants. If you try to implement this, and I think Verkotteren has tried to implement this, and the constants are kind of atrocious. I don't have hard numbers, but it's not so easy to. I don't know if you could compute cryptographic size examples of Jacobians with this, or if you can, not easily. So here's a question. So remember, in my hyperelliptic case, I could have started with the full affine hyperelliptic curve, y squared equals p of x, only throwing out the point infinity. But then I would have had the same problem, that I couldn't lift x and y both nicely, or either one nicely. I would have had to lift both of them to nasty p-adic series, and that would have made things worse. I mean, the only reason that I'm standing here giving this talk is because that algorithm works really well precisely when you do the x goes to x to the p thing, so only you have only half of the complexity in some sense. I mean, you make lots of powers of x, and you only throw in y's when you really need to. So this leaves the question, does it help to throw out extra points in this situation? If you throw out certain extra points, you can get a Frobenius of x goes to x to the p. Geometrically, what you have to do is you have this curve mapping down to the p1, the x line, and what you have to do is throw out the points where this map fails to be etal. And if you do that, that's precisely what I did in my case. I threw out the points where p, y, you know, where I got a double value of y. And if you do that, then you can lift Frobenius. But the trouble is, you have to throw out a certain, you're inverting some resultant, which may have somewhat high degree. And it's not clear how easy it is to deal with the cohomology in that case, especially if that resultant, the resultant, that could be kind of messy. If it has repeated roots, that might be a problem. And here's a question which maybe seems premature, but I don't think it's completely ridiculous. Is there any hope of doing this, for instance, for surfaces? So John Voigt has gotten interested in this question recently, and he hasn't done anything yet, but I'm hoping in the next few months he will try this and see whether one can actually do this for surfaces. There are maybe some interesting reasons why you would want to do it for three folds connected to mirror symmetry, but I'm not going to go there right now. Okay, so another variation I promised is less memory. There's an interesting technique that originally was suggested by Alan Lauder. Ralph Gapron, one of Gerhard's students, pursued this in some detail, and Hendrik Ubrechts, who's another student of Verkotteren, has really managed to get this working really well. The idea here is you don't think about a single variety. You think about a whole family of varieties all at once. This is philosophically based on what Deligne did to originally prove the Vane conjectures. You don't look at single varieties, you look at them in families, and somehow you get more control. And something like that happens here. The reason is that the Frobenius action on a single variety is just something you have to compute in terms of the forms on the individual variety, but on a family, you get extra structure. You get a certain differential equation on the cohomology. You get what's called the Gauss-Monnier connection, and it gives you Fuchsian differential equations. And that differential equation actually sort of it turns into a differential equation on the Frobenius action on the whole family. So instead of trying to think about how Frobenius acts on these two infinite dimensional vector spaces, you just have a family of finite dimensional vector spaces. And this Frobenius is some sort of, you get some matrix whose entries are functions on some base, and they satisfy some differential equation. So all you need to do is put in an initial condition, and you're good. And the initial condition will come from the Frobenius action on cohomology somewhere else in the family. So you start with some horribly complicated variety here. You put it in some one-parameter family. Maybe it's some linear thing. It's a pencil. It's some much simpler curve over here. Maybe it's defined over a smaller field. That's the trick that Ubrechts used in what I'm about to show you, or about to mention. Or it might have extra symmetries, which, as I said at the beginning, are always helpful. So here's the example. Here's the sort of the best example I know of, because it's the simplest. And this example really goes back to Dwork. So this is really quite an old example. but has some new computational life in it. P is not 2, look at the Legendre family of Lipkin curves, y squared equals x, x minus 1, x minus lambda, universal Lipkin curve with 2 torsion, with full 2 torsion. The Durand cohomology on each fiber is on each smooth fiber. There are throw out lambda equals 0, 1, and infinity. The middle cohomology is generated by the forms dx over y and x dx over y. And the Gauss-Monty connection, it doesn't really matter what it is. The point is that you can very explicitly compute it. And it's not even that difficult. Again, people who do things like mirror symmetry have gotten very good at doing this. So find a physicist to help you do this. It's amazing how good physicists are at doing this kind of algebra that you'd think mathematicians would know how to do. So you write down this Gauss-Monty connection, and then this Frobenius action, you have to pick some Frobenius lift on the lambda line, so like maybe lambda goes to lambda to the p or something. And then the point is that there's this commutation relation between the Frobenius and the differential and the differential operator. And so if you write out a matrix, say, but you write out the action of Frobenius on these two generators as, you know, you make some 2x2 matrix, you have some you get some differential equations satisfied by the entries of that matrix. And so if you happen to have, if you happen to know the Frobenius action on some fiber, for instance, you can pick a CM elliptic curve, and then you can actually explicitly write down the Frobenius action. Then you can use that as an initial condition and interpolate all the way around. And what's really nice here is that you avoid having to deal with these infinite dimensional vector spaces, which is not just a savings in principle, it really is good in practice. You're taking advantage of, if you take advantage of the Fuchsian property of the differential equation, which essentially says that they have regular singular points, then you get to save a lot of, you get a space savings, essentially, because these Frobenius things are certain power series in my parameter, which was lambda on my previous slide. But if this Fuchsian property tells you that you can sort of iteratively compute this thing, and you only need a few terms of the series in order to determine the next one. So you have this window that slides along, and as soon as you stop using the series representation of a term, you specialize it to the value you're interested in. So you don't have to store, you know, sort of as many actual series in lambda as you thought you had. You only have to store series sort of in the window and just values before that. So that really is helpful. It's especially good in higher dimensions, but it's already pretty good for curves. So Houbrecht sat down and implemented this for hyperelliptic curves, and it made it into the new Magma release. And, you know, I encourage you to try it. It's pretty effective. I don't have timing off the top of my head, but quite good. I mean, it is a little more complicated to implement, but so this maybe doesn't work for all hyperelliptic curves. You may have some extra restrictions, but it's sort of generic restrictions. You can easily make random curves that will satisfy these conditions. Here's a question at the interface between the two things I wrote down previously. Is there a good way to deform non-degenerate curves? So if you give me a Newton polygon, say, well, this is a simple example, but say you give me some complicated Newton polygon, and you have some curve with that Newton polygon, and you want to compute the zeta function. Is there a sort of a nice choice of an easy curve of the same shape that you can deform to? I don't actually know. And that really matters. I mean, so what Houbrecht was using in his situation was he was using the fact that his thing really screams when you work over large fields of small characteristic. This is maybe the crypto case. Because there, he deforms to a curve over the prime field, which is trivial to compute with. But, you know, I'm also interested in the case where you work with large genus over a small field. And there, you don't have that trick. And if you're dealing with, say, non-degenerate curves, I don't know what a good, easy curve is to use as the initial condition. And so the last thing I wanted to mention, since I'm basically out of time, I really will stop with this, is that you can actually go to higher dimensions too. So this is an example I did with Tim Abbott and David Rowe were undergraduates who were looking for a summer project last summer, and I said, hey, come implement this. It's easy to implement. So they did. So you take a hypersurface at P3. This had better be smooth. So P is some homogeneous polynomial in 4 variables. And now the trick is you invert the paradigm I suggested at the beginning. So instead of taking x and cutting stuff out of it to get something affine, I cut x out of something else to make it affine. Namely, I cut x out of the ambient P3. and I get a smooth affine. And its coordinate ring is, you take this thing and you view it as graded, where W, X, Y, Z have degree 1, and P has degree, whatever its degree is, and you take the degree 0 part of that. That's some subring, and that's the coordinate ring of this U. The Durham cohomology of this is easy to compute. There's a beautiful paper by Griffiths that works this out. So I just handed them this paper and said, here, you know, this is the cohomology. This is how you're going to lift Frobenius. You just lift up, you basically take an actual Frobenius lift on P3. This really gives you something algebraic on P3. And then when you cut out the hypersurface, P tilde, which is the lift of P, yeah, you get a series here. Again, this is divisible. This is integral, so this makes sense p-adically. And they implemented this, and it was pretty easy, and we actually got some results. So for example, we were able to compute coordinate K3 surfaces, compute some data functions over fields, not just F2, but we got up to about F19, which this is, when you get to this point, you're really at the point where you can't do this explicitly. I was going this far, I should say why I was going this far, I forgot to mention him on the slide. So Ronald von Lauck was looking for examples of, I was trying to explicitly exhibit K3 surfaces over, say, Q, where he could control the Picard number, where he could, say, prove that the Picard number was 1. And this calculation sort of helped him get some examples. He was originally trying to compute these zeta functions by physically counting points. He was able to do it over F2 and F3, but we can go further. There's a huge downside is because I was working on a three-dimensional thing instead of a two-dimensional thing. I had that many more variables running around. My power series are just bigger, and this is asymptotically a horrible, horrible thing to do. This has no right to work, but fortunately for me and my students, it did. You really should be either computing cohomology directly. This is the thing that John Voigt wants to do. Or doing a deformation, which is the thing that Alan Lauder suggested. Nonetheless, it would be useful to try to do this for at least get some more cases where we know. I mean, I know I can get, these surfaces, the interesting factor of the zeta function has degree 21. It's the primitive middle cohomology of a K3 surface. But if you go to surfaces in toric threefolds, you can get lots more examples where that factor is not even as big as 21. So you should still be able to work. And actually, Johan de Jong, not to be confused with Robin de Jong, has done this for weighted projective spaces rather than just absolute projective space. But there are lots of toric threefolds, so there are lots of ways to generate interesting examples, and nobody has actually tried to implement anything more general than that.